Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of the Sydney Writers Festival. You're listening to a live recording from Walsh Bay at the 2017 Festival.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to this session with Bernadette Brennan on writing Helen Garner. I'm Susan Windham. I'm a journalist, writer, former literary editor of the Sydney Morning Herald, and Helen Garner worshipper since I was a young journalist in the 1980s. So it's a real pleasure to be talking about this book, which I think many of us have been waiting for, even if we didn't realise it. Bernadette Brennan has spent most of her career as an academic, most recently as a senior lecturer in Australian literature at the University of Sydney. She's an outstanding literary critic and book reviewer, and her particular interest is in the relationship between literature and ethics. Her published work includes a monograph on the work of the writer Brian Castro and the edited collection Just Words, Australian Authors Writing for Justice. Fortunately for us, Bernadette left her full-time work about 3 years ago to work on the first full-length book about one of Australia's most admired and most controversial writers. The result is this excellent literary biography, A Writing Life, Helen Garner and Her Work, just published last month. It's an important book and a very readable one, and it's exciting in a way that biographies of writers aren't always. Almost everyone I know seems to be reading it at the moment. So I hope you either have or will, and it's my great pleasure to introduce Bernadette Brennan. Please welcome her.
Thank you.
Bernadette, how well did you know Helen Garner and her work before you decided to do this book?
Well, I knew Helen's work quite well. I had taught her work for about a decade or so. But personally, and I had studied as an undergraduate, but I had never immersed myself in it. I knew the books, and I suppose some of the later books, when I was teaching them, you'd get to read them each year when you're, you know, running a seminar or marking essays or whatever. How I knew Helen personally was quite interesting. I wrote to her when I was doing the book on Australian authors writing for justice and asked her if she'd like to write for that, because I think she'd just published Jo Cinque's Consolation at that point, and she wasn't interested in contributing at that point. She was too busy. She was doing other stuff. In 2010, I was approached by, or 2009, I was approached by a palliative care doctor, and he said, some of my colleagues would really like to have a day where you bring together counsellors, palliative care specialists, oncologists, and writers to talk about the relationship between narrative and healing. It was a course I'd been teaching at Sydney University, and a lot of doctors had done that course, and they were very interested in this relationship between writing and healing. And he said, "Would, you know, could you organise that day?" And I said, "Oh, yes, I could do that." So Helen, by that stage, had just published The Spare Room, and I thought she'd be an obvious choice as one of the writers. And I wrote to her and said, would you be interested in coming to Sydney and doing this? Oh, she was there like a shot. Absolutely, she says, I'm there. And that day I got to know her a certain amount, you know, with her talking. But also in the afternoon when the doctors and the oncologists were all talking, she was sitting next to me and she's in a chair and she's jumping around like she usually does. And at one stage she turns and she punches me in the leg and says, I just can't get enough of this stuff. And that was sort of my only personal connection with it.
Right.
And then it got to 2014, and I thought, nobody's written a definitive book of 40 years of work on Helen Garner. There's this massive archive in the National Libraries, the National Library of Australia. I think I'm probably the right person to write this. So I then contacted Helen and said, would you let me have a look at this archival material?
And was this the partly because you'd left your full-time work and had the time to work on
yes,
a book?
Yes, and I left my full-time work because I think probably as you've just left your full-time work, there comes a point when you think, I can't keep doing this amount of jobs and I'm tired and I'm not getting enough time for my own creative writing. So I had left. I wasn't sure what I was going to do and I wasn't sure what I was going to write about, but I knew I was going to do something that I was deeply interested in. And this was a project that caught my imagination. And I have to say, I think part of the joy people find in reading this book is the joy I had in researching and writing it. It was just a delight.
I remember bumping into you occasionally while you were doing the research, and you'd say, "I've just come back from reading all the letters in the archive." You could hardly contain yourself. It was fabulous.
It was a bit like that, yeah. And it was in Canberra. And
can we come back to that? I just want to ask you, first of all, how you got Helen's agreement, because I know other people have asked to write a biography, and she's turned them away. She doesn't want a biography written while she's alive. And I just wondered how you approached her so cleverly and how you got her to agree.
Look, it's an interesting thing. Approached her cleverly, yes, maybe, but just approached her with not really a great agenda, except that I think I'm the right person to write this book on you. And she said, "Come to Melbourne, let's have a chat." So we had a long, long talk. And she was saying, "Well, what do you want to do?" And I was just saying, "I don't know. I don't know what shape this book will take. I don't know how deeply I need to go into your life. I don't want a biography." I'm saying, "I don't really want to write a conventional biography. But I do have a strong feeling that if you're going to write about a writer's life, a writer's work or a biography, you have to engage with their written work, their published work." So I said to her, "Yeah, okay, I don't want to write a biography, but I don't know what I want to write, but I think something good would come of this." And we actually chatted about the Melbourne legal system, we chatted about her house, her dog, you know, all sorts of different things. And at the end of the day, I think she just thought, "I can trust you. You're the right person for the job." It wasn't difficult.
I mean, it's a challenge to write about a living writer, isn't it?
It is.
What did you offer her in return for her assistance and access?
Well, she didn't ask for anything, which was, I thought, pretty big of her. But I did say, "I will give you first right of veto over anything I write," because she had given me access to these letters, you know, written when she's 19, 20, 21, access to diaries and journals over, you know, more than a decade. And I thought, well, they're embargoed until some of them 2022, some of them 2035. And I thought, if I've got access to all of this, I bear that burden of responsibility very, very seriously. And I would like her to have right of veto. So I said to her, "You can have right of veto." There were times when we had a lot of discussions where she'd say, "Look, this is not to go in the book, but," and would tell me things. And I'm quite happy for it not to go in the book. I think, okay, well, people don't need to know that to understand something about Garner's writing, that sort of thing. So that was the right of veto. So I sent her the manuscript first, and she asked for two things to be taken out, and they were about other people, not about herself, and they were about being kinder to other people who are still alive. Anything about herself, that's fine.
And did those things alter our understanding in any way?
No, I don't think so. No, I wouldn't have. I would have pushed back a bit if they would have, but I was perfectly happy for them to go.
So tell us about these wonderful archives that you're the only person to have seen. I'm so jealous.
Oh, I think Sotiri Denakis got to see some of the Joe Cinque ones, and when he was making the film of Joe Cinque, Consolation. So, which is interesting in itself, because in that film there's a character that's not as strong in the book, who's a young man who worked with Joe, and there are lots and lots of letters from him to Helen and back again in the archive. I think that's interesting to know when you see the movie of that. These archives are fantastic. Firstly, the archivists at the National Library are sensational. There are a lot of them, and they range from the time when Helen's writing Cosmo Cosmolino, so it's 1990 onwards. For the First Stone, for instance, which is the first major piece of comprehensive archival material, there are her process journals that she keeps for all non-fiction books, where she writes every day, at the end of the day, what she's done, but also she writes her interviews with people, her dreams, her nightmares that she's having, and she pours herself into them. So the ones of This House of Grief, for instance, she comes back from court from horrendous days and just pours out the blackness onto the page as a way, I think, of dealing with it, making sense of it, making it coherent. And from there, she works to write the actual book.
Is it pages and pages every day?
Pages and pages. Some days pages and pages, some days 4 paragraphs, some days 3 paragraphs. Always quite a lot, and then always the emails she's sending to other people that night to, you know, tell them what's going on and the feedback she's getting or the phone calls she's having, all those sorts of things. Then there are the massive research materials. So in every major non-fiction book, there are huge collections of what she's researched, whether they're legal texts or whether they're cases of sexual harassment or folders on punishment and forgiveness, you know, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa when she's thinking about punishment and forgiveness in Jo Chinkwe's consolation. So they're eclectic, they're huge, and they're just so exciting. And I wasn't allowed to tell anyone about what I'd seen. So I'd spend my days in the National Library thinking, this is the best place in the whole world. And then suddenly, if anyone wants to bash Canberra, it doesn't work too well with me because I'd come out and hop on my bike and just think, oh, this is the most exciting place ever. But it was because these archives were actually so interesting. And then I had to distill what I took from them into the narrative that I've put into the book.
There were other archives, weren't there? The McPhee-Gribble archive? Is that a separate thing?
Yeah, there's a couple of things.
This is her publisher in the early years,
Hilary McPhee and Diana Gribble were the publishers for Ghana's first book and throughout until the 1990s. But so there's a couple of archives. So there's Hilary McPhee's private papers in the National Library, and it was there that I found the original manuscript for Cosmo Cosmolino, which was quite different to what happened. And then in Melbourne, at the Baillieu Library at Melbourne University, there's the Scripsy archives, which are the archives of the journal Scripsy, where Helen was deeply involved for a long time, writing, being a critic and those sorts of things.
And, of course, Michael Haywood, who's published your book and is now Helen's publisher, was one of the Scripsy
editors.
That's
when he first met
her. It's lovely to see that circle completed.
Yes. Actually, there's some good letters where she tears strips off him early on for not being a good enough editor. You know, it's don't be mealy-mouthed, tell me why this story isn't good enough or something. They're pretty wonderful back in 1981. And then there's another archive, the McPhee-Gribble archives are then also in the Baillieu Library at Melbourne University. So there's Hilary McPhee's private papers in Canberra, and then there's that one. There's also Axel Clark's archive at the National Library, and he has separated out his archive into all sorts of different areas, but there's a specific one which deals with Helen Garner.
And we'll come to Axel Clark and the Clark family, which I think is really interesting. This is one of Helen's best friends until his death a few years ago, isn't it, Axel Clark, Manning Clark's son? Okay, so can you single out a couple of the most interesting, unexpected finds that came up? I mean, you did find a story,
Yes, okay, well, a visitation, yes. Yeah. So the most unexpected finds I found were to do with the time around of writing Cosmo Cosmolino. So I found this long story called A Visitation in Hilary McPhee's papers, and it went for 35 typed A4 single-spaced pages, and it's an extraordinarily dark, gothic story. And I'm reading this thinking, hang on a minute, this has never been published. This is, what is, and it's kind of gold when you get to an archive. You think, oh, I found something that no one else has got. I immediately text Helen and say, what's going on? This story of Visitation. And she says, oh, isn't that the middle story in Cosmo Cosmolino? And I said, no, it's not. That's what I thought at first as well. That's called A Vigil. So then she writes back and says, oh yes, I think I remember writing that story. But I think I've only ever shown it to Alison Clark, but nobody else. And I said, would you like me to get the staff of the National Library to copy it for you, send you a copy? Oh, no, she said. I don't want to see it. I remember the sense of strain when I was writing it. So that was a bit of gold. Finding out that Cosmo Cosmolino originally was going to be 7 stories about the soul was gold, and she did publish most of those other stories in different forms and in different books. The real gold was a lot of stuff in all these archives, which comes down to a scrap of paper that was torn off in the middle of the Jo Chinkwe archive, in which she's written in her big cursive hand, "Ah, the things we cannot say." and there's just so much information that she distills. So in The First Stone, for instance, she distills it down to those anecdotes she tells, lots and lots of anecdotes. In the Joe Cinque Consolation, there's lots that she leaves out that she found out about Anu Singh, about her relationship with Joe, about different things that were said, but she doesn't put them in. Again and again, saying in her journals, I have the power to hurt people very powerfully here. She's very conscious of that. So even though she gets criticised often when she publishes these books, you know, you've caused hurt and damage, she's acutely aware of that, and there's a lot that she doesn't publish. And I didn't feel it was up to me to publish that either, because it's about ethics. It's what is the right thing to do, and ethically that is not the right thing to do, I think.
How much did ethics give you a framework for this book and your interaction with the book, her books?
Entirely. It would have been possible to write a book that could have maybe been some kind of sensational, oh, you know, here's the tell-all of Helen Garner and her life or something like that. I had no interest in doing that, and I don't understand why anyone would want to. In terms of ethics, my ethics are that here is a woman I deeply respect, came to respect enormously the more I got to know her, whose writing I came to respect hugely the more I immersed myself in it, who is a living, breathing human being who lives next door to her daughter and her son-in-law and her grandchildren, who has partners and sisters and nieces and nephews and friends. Why would I want to write something that would damage this person? I wasn't intending to write some hero worship kind of thing, but I wasn't interested in expose. That's the word. And I've had a lot of readers say to me, it's a very respectful biography, and I like that. That works for me. That's important to me.
You certainly at times hint at things that raise questions that made me want to ask more. Very tantalising.
That's just clever writing.
Yes. Tell me about your process of getting to know Helen and how much time you spent interviewing her. Was it hours and hours and hours?
Formally, there would have been maybe sort of four formal face-to-face interviews that went for a couple of hours. There was constant, I'd send an email with, might have 15 questions in it. These are the questions I'm thinking about. And she would often send me responses to that. As anyone, and I'm sure there's people in this audience who know Helen Garner, who are very close to Helen Garner, she's wonderful on the email and the texts. And all you've got to do is send one and you'll be delighted for the rest of the day. They'll come bouncing back and forth. So there was a lot of that. There was times when I'd say things like, I'd be in the middle of writing the Joe Cinque chapter and I'd think, hang on, that's about when Di Gribble died and she personally is in a very dark space at this point. Di Gribble was very close to Helen. They were very firm friends. So I send, it's a Sunday afternoon, I send her a text and saying, hey, did you give one of the eulogies at Di Gribble's funeral? And I get one back straight away, yeah. Do you want to see it? Oh, hang on, let me think for a long time about that. That would be a yes. So, oh, well, I'd have to find it. My photocopy's, you know, not working, whatever. But within 2 hours, she sends it to me. So it was formal interviews. It was email interviews. It was chats on the phone. There was a couple of evenings at the Gin Palace in Melbourne, which I think you've probably had a few with Helen too.
She keeps promising. I don't get to Melbourne enough.
Oh, it's not
enough.
Bad. It's comfy couches. They do a good red wine if you're not into martinis. Over the 2 years, that's sort of, we became friends.
Really. Yeah, good. And did your, I mean, you said you came to respect her more and more. What did you learn about her as a person that was different from what you thought before?
I learned that she's far more tortured than I realised. We all know that she has self-doubt because she puts it in the book. I learned that she is far more rigorously intelligent than I realised, that she has a brain that snaps just straight away onto an idea, a thought, and she will push you, that she'll say, well, I, you know, push that a bit further. Why do you think that? Or let's talk about that. I learnt that she's an extraordinary reader. Almost every book that a new Australian writer, a new Australian book had come out, we would discuss, she had read. And she's a great mentor to a lot of younger writers. But I also learnt that she challenges herself, I think more than any critic challenges herself. And she spirals into pits of self-doubt still, right now, you know, last week before this latest essay. It's constant. And I think that's an extraordinary quality in a writer of such renown, if you like.
Well, it's probably why she writes so beautifully. Or I don't know if you can have one without the other. I hope you can, but she really does. She never lets up on herself, does she? And I was going to say that two things that really, really came out of your book were how hard she works on her writing, how she writes draft after draft after draft. I think, was it 18 drafts of Jo Cinque? Unbelievable. And not just drafts, but completely changing the shape and form.
Completely changing them.
Approach.
Which is fascinating because we all read Helen Garner and we think, oh, we get that. That reads so easily on the page. And some critics can say, oh, she's basically just come home from court and, you know, written in a journal, I feel this or I think that. But then when you see the rigorous process she goes through to get to that point, and you know, on the 18th draft, she's still taking out that adverb. She's still just changing that clause around just to make it a bit tighter. So she never backs off in, I can get this better. So that's pretty admirable, I think. And I learnt to be a better writer by working from her, which I found a fascinating process. There'd be sentences I'd think, oh, way too many words. No, that's got to go. And I'm paring it down, paring it back. You don't need this. So that was really quite fun to discover that.
A great masterclass.
Yeah.
Well, tell us about the actual writing. You have a wonderful and very original form, which you should explain. And I wonder how you came to that through considering different ways of writing the book.
Yeah, well, so literary biography, an old form. And there's some fine, wonderful literary biographies around, even contemporary ones. Hermione Lee's on Penelope Fitzgerald. Yeah. I mean, we're all a writer's festival. We're interested in writers. We're interested in writers' lives. So I do think if you're going to write a biography of a writer, you have to engage with their published works because the essence of identity of any writer is arguably what they've written, and that is their life. And with Garner and most other writers, what they've read. So I thought, okay, that has to be dealt with. With a writer like Garner who represents herself so powerfully, you cannot just divorce her work from her life. So that has to somehow, I've got to find a form for that. So, okay, what do I do here? There's usually a scholarly monograph. I could probably have done that standing on my head, you know, in 6 months. That's just an analysis of the work. Here it is. It's fairly dry. Let's go through that. Then there's the biographical. How much of the biographical do you put in? So I thought, Garner herself has been a genre crosser for 40 years. So as a mark of respect, the least I can do is try something new. Let's see if I can make a new kind of genre as a sign of respect for what she's tried to do. And I came up with this idea of a literary portrait. That's what I was going to do because I had looked at the portrait that Jenny Sages had painted of Helen Garner. And I thought, I could do that with words. And then I read the Janet Malcolm essay, 41 First Starts, where she tries, in a sense, to capture David Sahl's life as a kind of portrait. And by writing it in a fragmentary way, in a sense, acknowledges you can't possibly capture a person's life. And I thought, that's my model. So this is going to be a portrait where the spine of the book will be her published works. And through that, I will weave her life and I will go back and I'll touch bits up and I'll add a bit here and a bit of a shadow there and hopefully at the end offer you a more robust sense of Helen Garner, the writer and the person, which is why I finished with her last name. The last word of the book is Helen, which is why I wanted to give her the last word because it was about saying I'm going to give you an image or a picture or a more full idea. But ultimately, I'm handing it over to her.
It's actually a letter from Helen that finishes the book, which is very moving. It's beautiful. Yeah. So many things to talk about. Okay. Well, let's go. let's get to her books for a while. Monkey Grip. You say that. I suppose I'm interested in when you were reading her works, how your response to them, reading them now, was different from your original response when you might have read the books for the first time or again and again over the years. And you say that to your surprise, you consider Monkey Grip her most important work. Did you not think that before, and why is it now?
No. I'd be interested to know who in this audience first read Monkey Grip when it was first published. And are your eyes sparkling? Do you remember this moment? There's this strong sense of people of that generation who read Monkey Grip when it was first published, and there was nothing like it. And I still keep getting that, although I'm now getting that from young, largely female readers, which is fascinating, that this is speaking to their lives in a different way. When I say, to my surprise, the most important, it was one of those moments. I'm halfway through the research. I'm decided I had to write it chronologically because so much of Garner's writing is to do with the social, cultural and political events of her time. So I couldn't jump about too much. So I'm halfway through. I'm in Melbourne. I'm in the text boardroom. And Michael Hayward says to me, in his usual way, he says, what do you say is the most important book in Garner's oeuvre? And I was actually a bit stumped. I didn't know what to say. And then the more I thought of it, I just thought, at that point, it has to be Monkey Grip, because not only did it make her a writer, but because the responses to it were so intense from the critics that she then spent so many years, 15 years, paring down everything she wrote, making it the tightest form she possibly could to prove that she was a writer. So I thought it was important at that point of my research that it seemed to have shaped the way she wrote. And then she gets to 50 years of age and she basically says, blow this, I'm off. And on come the big Baroque sentences.
With Cosmo Cosmolino.
And turning 50 and being with Murray Bale and all these life events when she's turning 50 and thinking of mortality and...
Turning to religion and
spirituality takes over hugely. And so... So halfway through this book, I say that I think that's the case. And when I get to the end of the book, I say I can't answer anymore. I don't know anymore. And if you're asking how my reactions to her writing changed, by the end of this book, I can, obviously, think of each book and each screenplay and each essay separately, and I could give you a lecture on each one. But actually, I don't want to, because I now think of it as a body of work. And I love that that's now... solidified in my mind as the 40 years of work that I can see as a whole. So I can't tell you what my favourite Garner book is, for instance, or yesterday someone tweeted in a question, what would be the book you'd recommend me to read of Helen Garner's? I can't make that recommendation, which I quite like.
What was the first one you read?
I think the first book I ever read of Garner's may have been... Honour and Other People's Children?
It's mine.
Yeah.
I fell in love with her at that moment.
I still think Honour is one of the greatest stories she's ever written. I could read it again and again.
It's tiny. It's this little... I mean, all her books are slim, but this is a tiny little book of two short stories about sort of triangular relationships in a way. Honour is about a man and his current partner and his ex-partner and the daughter of the second relationship.
Kath and Frank have been married before. They've been divorced for 5 years. No, they've been separated for 5 years. And their daughter Flo is about 10. And Frank now wants to get a divorce to marry Jenny. So it's about adults acting honourably in the face of huge rifts in personal relationships and what that does to the daughter. But there's some scenes in that, and I quote that one bit in the book where they're telling their daughter Flo that they're getting a divorce, and it's a paragraph that has not aged since 1978 when she first wrote it, and then when it was published in 1980. It's an extraordinary one. You know, the child is weeping for the family they could have been and all the things that have gone wrong, and the child has put her hands underneath her legs so neither parent could hold her hands while she wept and the tears come down. It's extraordinary.
It is. And I don't often remember the endings of books, but the last few paragraphs of Honour where these two women are trying to find a way to relate to each other, and the child is watching them, and they sit, the two women sit on either end of a seesaw and just hang in the air, this wonderful balance. And it sounds kind of cliched, but it's just perfect.
Yeah.
It still gives me goosebumps. Mm.
and here's the thing. So it's a bit of a treat that most of us don't get the time to do this, but when you can immerse yourself into a book, so sure, Honor is this big, and I've read it I don't know how many times. In writing about it this time, and it's in fragments, like so many of Garner's books are, and I realised that every fragment, bar when the family goes to the funeral of the father-in-law, starts with Kath's approach to a house. So either her welcome into a house or her approach to a house. I said this to Garner. She said, I didn't notice that, which is just wonderful. But you suddenly see the structure that comes out of it and you think, this is such a simple story. But when you spend your time with it, you think, that is so well structured. And it's about belonging. Where is she going to belong? Who will she belong to? And she will be alone. And how does she negotiate her new life as a divorced woman whose child has gone to live with her ex-husband? So, very moving all these years later.
And yet I remember once telling Helen how much I admired and loved that story, and she said, oh, really? I don't really think it worked. And
well, that's her second story. So she writes Monkey Grip. She's suddenly famous. Everybody's, you know, buying this book. It's all fantastic. She's a writer. She's dirt poor. She gets a literature fund board, $6,000, I think it was. She goes to Paris with her daughter Alice, who's then 8, and she's out of Melbourne, which is good. Now she's a writer, and she's living in Paris. She's desperately poor, desperately homesick, quite lonely. And she writes, she thinks, oh, well, I'm a writer now. So she writes the new manuscript, which was called Honor, and thinks, I'm a bit stuck. Hilary McPhee and Diana Gribble come to Paris to read it. They sit on those horrible chairs in the Tuileries, those awful iron chairs that you can't get comfortable on, and they just say, oh, it's awful. And they come round to Helen's, Helen says she remembers them turning up at her door with a bottle of whiskey. Hilary says, no, Helen came round to the Hotel Esmeralda anyway. We all did drink quite a bit, and we just said, Helen, it's terrible. And so what she does is she then pulls it apart and pairs it back and turns it into two stories, Honour and then Other People's Children, and says, oh, no, it's terrible, it didn't work. But actually, that first one did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was the other thing. I mean, I was struck by the work and the agonising that she puts into every book. I was also struck from reading your book by how she's had negative reviews. She's had fabulous reviews and obviously lots of people who love her books. But all along she's had critics who just tore her apart, and she's had to survive that. I mean, Monkey Grip, as you say, had its critics, and it goes on and on and on, and she's had to... How do you think she's dealt with that? Do you think she's sort of taken something from the critics, or has she just kind of fought back and said, I'm going to be me? Or...
I think she tried early on to fight back, I'm going to be me. I think actually she's shattered every time she gets a negative criticism. She says all the time, I'm stronger now, I can handle this, but then she gets shattered, which I think is understandable. We all get shattered if, you know, someone gives us a bad critique. You think, oh! But I think there's an extra element on that, and I think it's because she writes so much of herself. And by herself, I mean her actual self, her real self, and her constructed self and her life into her work, so that when the criticism comes, I think there's an extra element, as in we're critiquing, in a sense, your life, your relationships, your choices. And that is possibly a tougher form of criticism than it might be for me, if someone's going to write a critical piece on that and say, well, look, you know, you missed this out, or this was sloppy, or this was bad. You think, okay, well, that was my research method or my writing or something, but it wasn't actually about my life, my relationships, my psyche, in a sense. So I wonder about that.
Mm. Would you be able to summarise what type of criticism? Because I think there have been several categories of criticism she's had over the years.
Yeah. I know she's very wounded by Helen Garner just writes her diary and publishes it. She's very offended at the thought that people don't respect the crafting that she puts into these ideas. Having said that she's hurt by all that negative criticism, on the other hand, she does like a bit of a fight. She likes a good stoush. And when I said in my first Stone chapter that I thought she was unnecessarily harsh on these girls and it was unfounded and whatever, and she actually said, go BB, you know, have a go at me. That's great. She said, it's very bracing, your chapter on the first stone. So in one sense, she's not merely, you know, oh, I need everybody to love me. She wants good criticism, but I think she gets offended if it's not respecting the craft. And one thing she did say to me at the end of this book, she said, oh, you know, thank you for writing it. And then she said, thank you for taking me seriously as an artist. And I thought that was quite moving. So I think it is that thing of people might not suggest that Helen Garner is an artist. Yes, she's a stylist and she's all the things, but really she's just writing her own story, so, you know, there's not much. It's pretty easy, we could all do it. I think that really offends her. And she knows she's smart, she knows she's that good, but she's also riven by the self-doubt, so...
I just wanted to quote you because a lot of the time... you refrain from direct comment on her life, her work. I mean, it's filtered all the way through, but there's only a few occasions where I think you do get quite tough and opinionated, and one of them is, this is a quote, Helen squandered opportunities for rigorous undergraduate study because she was young, egocentric and irresponsible.
This is me as a school monitor.
Is this the academic speaking?
That's a funny one. I think Owen Richardson did a review in The Age and said, oh, I think sanctimonious or something, or she's channeling Garner there.
Well, were you channeling Garner? Because she has had that insecurity herself.
In one sense I was, but in another sense it became a really easy shorthand way to sum up a bit of what was happening in her life at that point. And so I was reading these letters, which you should never judge anyone on what they're writing when they're 19, 20, 21. But she really wasn't going to tutorials and she really was discovering this whole new world of sex and alcohol. And she didn't do her work and she didn't study. And she says, oh, I'm a failure. You know, I got a third class honours degree and, you know, I was hopeless. So it was it was her response to herself at that time. It was the reading of her letters and the bits of journals she'd kept from that time. And it was a shorthand way of me actually sort of saying, well, here's an easy moment where you can say, look, she really didn't shine at this point. So maybe I was being sanctimonious, but she was. She was irresponsible in terms of her studies. So it was, that's why she got the third class honours. So, and why is that important? Because it doesn't really matter what you get at university, you know, when you're 20 or 21. But it matters if when you're 50 and 55 and you're coming up against an academic institution in the first stone, that you are cowed by academics and you're cowed by the patriarchal institutions of the university. So that's why it was important to put in that early bit that she sense that she failed at university, that she says she associates universities with the bad father, and the father being such an important, powerful force in her life. And that's why it matters what happened back there when she was 19, 20, 21 to what she's writing now.
Yeah. Mm. I want to talk about the first stone and the move into non-fiction, but can I first ask you, because you've raised the figure of the father, about what I see, and even more now, as an enormous influence on her work from the men in her lives.
And yes.
The different periods that are marked by father, Javo in Monkey Grip, the three husbands, and so on. What can you how that throws light?
Helen has, because she's said and she's published these words, saying that her father was her destructive relationship with her father was possibly the most important factor in her, in shaping her and the drama of her life, and a central factor in her writing. So that opens up an area to go into about her father. If you read any of her work, and you can see in Dreams of Her Real Self, that in the book that you first commissioned, that essay you commissioned for your book, she lays it out there about how powerful and opinionated and he did become cruel, her father was, for a long time. They fell out when she was a teenager. There came a point when he exorcised Helen from the family. She was thrown out. No one was allowed to go to her wedding. Her mother and one sister defied him. He did say to another sister, and this isn't in the book, you know, if you go, I will decamp to the farm. I will leave. And he did decamp to the farm. I spoke to another one of her sisters who said, confirmed everything Helen had ever said about the powerful father, and said, Helen made peace with him. I never did. I then met a fantastic woman who was a very close friend of Helen's at university. She's a professor here in Sydney. And the best part about talking to her was talking about what the father was like from her perspective, because she used to go home to the Ford family house and sit around the table, and she confirmed that he was powerful, he was a bully, he was cruel, but he was also incredibly charming and had real personality. And that flows through, I think, into Helen. Because I then asked her about the eulogies of her parents. Oh, would you like those too? Oh, yeah, that might be an idea. So she sent me the eulogy that they all wrote, the siblings wrote together, and that her sister Catherine delivered for her father, and parts of that are in the book. So he was just an extremely important and powerful figure in her life, and it comes through in all the writing. And, yeah.
I've left out several of the men. Axel Clark, who was her close friend, and it seems she was looking for something of a father figure in Manning Clark.
Yes.
and that whole family. Yes. That sort of replaced her own family for a while.
Yes.
And became more clearly then than I'd ever realised the model for her novel The Children's Bar.
Yeah, yeah.
It was problematic in that way that she'd drawn so much on them as characters. But Manning Clark was an important influence, the historian.
Huge influence in her life, as was Dinfner. So together, he definitely as the father figure. There's some letters she wrote to Axel where she started on talking about the football, and three pages later she's still talking about Manning. You know, I met your father, and would your father do this, whatever. But Manning Clark was the person who introduced her to classical music, which she says after reading and writing is the most important thing in her life. She found the Clark's house in Canberra to be an exotic place because there were people who were interested in ideas. They were all involved in the university. Her family, her father, she says, never read a book. No one in her family had been to university. She was the eldest child. She thought this was this amazing opening to a world of ideas and culture that she hadn't had as the daughter of a well-to-do but not highly educated Geelong wool merchant.
Mm.
So the Clarks were hugely important, and Axel did become her best friend. And I think one of the quotes I put there as an epigraph is one letter where she says to him, I think you have been the most important person in my life.
Mm. What was it about him that was so appealing and so important to her?
Well, they became very close friends. That was the first thing that happened, and they stayed very close friends. They never became lovers, which is probably a good thing for their friendship. But I think they just recognised something deep in each other, and perhaps all of us have got someone that we met at that point in our lives when we're 19, 20, and they are the solid friend that goes through years and years with you. And he was that person.
Mm.
And
mm.
she became very involved in his life when he was married and his children, and she's godmother to one of his children, and she's still close to those children. And
so it's intellectual and sort of personal and intimate.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Look, I want to take some of your questions too, so, you know, time runs away. Let's turn to the non-fiction and that whole phase of Helen's life, which she began after Cosmo Cosmolino, and partly, I think, because she was trying to differentiate her work from Murray Bale's work, who owned fiction in that household. Is that a good thing? I mean, do you see her as growing as a writer by becoming, you know, sort of returning to her journalistic roots in a way and then taking it a whole lot further.
Yes, I do see that as a good thing. I think, of course, the first book she writes after Cosmo Cosmolino is The First Stone, which becomes enormously controversial for all sorts of reasons and continues to be so. But in a sense launches her down a career which leads to True Stories, where she brings out her non-fiction and says, hey, I am a non-fiction yes. writer, and I think her non-fiction is sensational, and she gets stronger with that. In terms of the fiction, I think it's a shame that she stopped writing at that point, but I don't know that it's finished. And then, of course, when The Spare Room comes out in 2008... we all get excited and think, a novel, finally, you know, Helen Garner's gone back to a novel. And then, of course, people say, well, it's not really a novel because it's, you know, it's so close to her life and off the fight goes again. I think what I decided as I looked at this 40-year career is that she was going to perfect just about everything. So she was also a songwriter, which most people don't know about, and a number of her songs have been performed, and I mention them in the book. I don't think she's a great poet, but don't tell her that. Don't listen, Helen.
Is there much poetry? Is there much poetry?
She writes little bits, and there's some there. And her first publication actually was a poet in Kate Jennings' Mother, I'm Rooted.
Oh, right.
She writes an untitled poem. Yeah. She's a deep lover of poetry, and both her honours theses were on poets Christopher Brennan and Francois Villon. And she's steeped in poetry, steeped in it. But other than that, she's mastered screenplays, she's done songwriting, she's done short stories, she's done novels, she's done non-fiction. And now I think what she's doing is she's showing you how she can craft a diary with these diary fragments she's putting out. You think, here comes another genre that she's going to show you that she can master. Mm. That's what I think she's doing.
But you mean now, in the latest now. Book, Everywhere I Look?
Everywhere I Look, where she's published those three large excerpts of her journals, and then she published another one in Freeman's, the New York anthology. And I don't know what she's going to do with that, but I think that's just another hint to say there's not a genre I haven't covered here. I can master any of these. I think she likes the challenge.
Mm.
And of course, these long essays that we're getting in the monthly, as well as all the reviews and the cinema reviews and the theatre reviews, whatever.
Just returning to The First Stone for a moment, the only book that had come out on Helen's work before this, I'm sure there's been much academic publication, but the only book that had come out was Karen Goldsworthy's short monograph, which came out after The First Stone and was truly a study of her work, but very interesting and I think still very relevant. It was a feminist reading of her work, not a simplistic feminist reading, but a feminist reading. Were you bouncing off any of Karen's ideas in your book?
Well, the thing is, when you go to write a book about a writer and someone else who has the talent of Karen Goldsworthy has already written a critical book, you sort of think, oh, well, what am I going to say that can add to that early part? Was I bouncing off it? I certainly read Karen's book, and I read it a few times, and Karen is arguably one of the best critics we've got in the country. So what I was trying to do was... So I would read it and I'd put it aside and then I'd write my bits, but then I'd have to go back and check that there wasn't anything glaring that I had left out that Karen had referenced. Karen makes a few absolutely essential points and makes them better than I could have made or anyone else has made. And so I quote them when I can in the book. And one of them in terms of The First Stone, which is absolutely essential. And it's interesting because I think a number of critics have said that, you know, I said this. Well, I actually quote Karen saying it in the book, was that the whole of The First Stone drama was played out in it was a traumatic psychic drama for Garner on Melbourne University campus. And Goldsworthy says that quite simply, and she doesn't have the length to go into it, but it's absolutely right. And so I quote that and then bounce from there. I had time to develop it more. And because I had access to Garner's journals at the time, which Karen didn't have, and Garner's dreams at the time, which Karen never had, I could add to that. So I could jump off from that point and show just how deeply psychic this drama was. A drama about fathers, a drama about Murray Bale, a drama about inadequacy academically, all those sorts of things that she was coming up against, which meant that she just could not appreciate that what had happened to those girls was as powerful as they felt it to be. She just couldn't get that, and she just couldn't understand the academic take on what happened. So Keren was invaluable for those sorts of things, yeah. But her book then stops in 1996. She says True Stories is in proof copy, and that's it. Well, that's 1996, so that's a long time ago. Yeah, there's an awful lot of books since then. So, yeah. And so in one sense, her book's a gift in that it's the beginning. It's the first intro into Ghana criticism, but it's also written for a sort of late high school, early university kind of readership. Mine was very much for a Ghana readership.
Okay. Does being a grandmother, I mean a mother of course, but a grandmother change her approach to her writing? You know, her non-fiction has been about young people, children, the death of children. I just wonder, and the way that her sympathies lie, you always have a clear idea of who Helen's feeling most for. I just wondered if it had either focused her or softened her. Is that relevant?
Oh, I think it is. Focused and softened, absolutely, in huge
amounts. She has three grandchildren now.
Three grandchildren, and she writes in one of the essays of The Feel of Steel that when Olive, the first grandchild, was born, she was poleaxed by an emotion that love didn't even come close to the word. They are incredibly important to her life. They live next door. In fact, they've got a connecting bit in their houses now. So they, you know, she's always taking them to football or, you know, celebrating a win in football or whatever's going on. They're a huge part of her life. And I think they influence her emotions and therefore her focus of what she's interested in.
This house of grief about a man who drowns his own three children. You know, how could she possibly separate that from her own life?
Precisely, especially when her grandsons at the time were young little boys at exactly the time she's writing it. So one thing that I couldn't put in the book because it didn't work and the editor kept taking it out was that she wrote The Spare Room in 6 months. It sort of, she says it burst out of her. And she wrote that and completed that in the early months of sitting in court all day during this house of grief. And I think that's really interesting.
Yes, isn't it?
Yes, that she was coming home at night to write this novel full of anger and fury, which, sure, was about a time that happened earlier.
How long after the events where she looked after for 3 weeks a dying friend in her house?
In 2006.
Expressed such anger and anguish about it.
2006, so she's writing the book 2 years later.
2 years later.
But she's writing it also at a time where psychically all day long she's in court hearing the early cases of the early trials of the Farquharson murders. So I think that's really interesting.
So much going on. It's extraordinary. How has Helen changed Australian writing?
She set the bar in terms of style, in terms of grammar, in terms of how one writes. I don't know if I can answer how she's changed Australian writing. I know that she's influenced a lot of younger writers, and I know she's mentored a lot of younger writers. So I think she's involved in Australian writing in a way that we don't readily acknowledge. I don't think I can really answer how she's changed it, really, because, I mean, what is Australian writing anyway? At the moment, we've got these extraordinary young novelists and poets coming through from all sorts of diverse backgrounds with voices that are so exciting. So I don't know if, you know, I don't really know how to answer that.
I thought she might have influenced a new kind of personal essay or journalism or I don't know. Anyway, I don't want to put words in your mouth. Let's take some audience questions. There is a microphone if you put up your hand. Let's take the one right at the back there, if someone can get there.
My question relates a bit to your last one, partly from being around the festival the last 2 days. What I was wondering about was some elements of synchronicity with other writers, and I'm thinking particularly of a beautiful reading of Georgia Blaine's work that I went to on Friday. And my question is, Reading your book, Bernadette, I thought that the final motif that was most powerful for me was forgiveness, and that capacity to go into the darker parts of all of our psyches, but in a way that is forgiving, and then ultimately forgiving ourselves and forgiving others. And I wondered to what extent that can be seen powerfully in writers like Georgia Blaine. So maybe that was a point of influence. What do you think?
Well, it may well have been, and I'm sure Georgia would have been well versed in Helen's work, and probably vice versa, I'd say. Forgiveness is a huge theme in Garner's writing. And I can't really say if there is a direct connection, but certainly there's a synchronicity. If you're going to read these writers, you can see the beauty in Blaine's writing that just got stronger and stronger as she developed as a writer. What do you think? You're an expert on Australian writing as well.
Oh, thanks. I think she probably influenced a whole generation in that way. I think Georgia was very much her own person. I wouldn't like to presume a direct influence there. But, I mean, Tegan Bennett Daylight's a writer proclaims Helen's influence on her. But I don't know. Writers have such different reasons for the... Let's have another question. I'm going to ask you something I forgot to ask you. Helen's reaction to reading the manuscript.
Classic.
Please put up your hand if you have a question.
Okay, so I send the manuscript to Helen and it goes express post, and it's the weekend of the election. And I say to her, with a bit of luck, we'll both have a relaxed weekend, because I feel sick that I've now sent her the manuscript. She's my first reader. And she feels sick that this manuscript is on its way. And Australia Post for once does a great job. And it's on her door. It's at her post office box at 9 o'clock the Friday morning. So I relax, because I think whatever happens, Helen's going to read this and she's going to scream no. She's just going to go, no way, no, no, no. And so there's silence on the Friday and the Saturday. On the Sunday, I get an email which is very short. Dear Bernadette, I know you're anxious about this, but I'm very tired and I haven't finished it, and I'll let you know. And I thought, yeah, okay, well, I wasn't that anxious, but that's fine. That night, I get I think it was a long text. No, 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 this is too biographical. You can't do this. Anyway, I just thought, I'm going to let this sit, because I knew that would be Helen's reaction. By the next morning, a few hours later, I get one saying, look, I'm so sorry. I've actually just got over the embarrassment of being written about. And I think that's really interesting, because we all buy Helen Garner's books. We all think, oh, Helen Garner, she's everywhere. We all know Helen Garner. She was so embarrassed about being the subject of a book. I just find that extraordinary. And she says, now that I've got over the embarrassment of being written about, she said, I can see this is a massive work of thinking, and you've seen me very deeply, and I love it. It's like the Jenny Sage's portrait, she said. And then she said, but it's like getting a lifetime worth of reviews and a massive hit of psychoanalysis in one go.
Wow.
And from there, we just laughed. And then she did what she always does. She says, but all will be well. That's one of her mottos.
Oh, how fantastic. All will be well. What a great endorsement. Yes.
Thank you for that wonderful talk. I wonder if you were surprised at the volley of criticism of Helen Garner following her book on The First Stone, when the academic literary experts rose like a coven of witches with a degree of venom which I found difficult to understand.
So the question was, how did I respond or feel about that vitriolic attack by largely academics on Helen after she published The First Stone. At the time, I was in an academic department. Not all academics were as aggressive, but yes, she was definitely taken down pretty powerfully by a lot of very aggressive and unforgiving academics. At the time when I first read it, I did not share that absolute fury, because I thought, she's been honest, she's put herself out here on the page, she said this is what I'm grappling with, and I didn't have that same fury. over the years, as I read that book again and again, and then as I came to write about that book, I changed my position again and again. Sometimes I read the book and I did get really cross with it. I thought, Helen, you just don't see this. And other times I thought, okay, I can see what you're doing here. A very interesting response I got this week from an academic, I think comes to play here. She said to me, I've read your book, I loved your book. She said, I found it mesmerising, which is a big word for me because I have not been a Garner fan since she published The First Stone. And I've tried to resist how much I loved Monkey Grip because I'm so angry at how high-handed she was towards young women. And she said, but reading your book, you've reminded me that a text is performative. And once I remember that, everything slips into place. So Helen did cop some serious abuse, and it caused her to spiral into a major depression. It had effects on her marriage and her life profoundly. But it's interesting that the modulating responses continue 20 years later. There is still anger amongst a lot of largely academic women, but there is also a changing of the view from others. So does that answer it? Mm.
Another question? No? Oh, okay. Let's make this the last one then. Thank you.
Bernadette, I really enjoyed the book. Thank you very much. I just wanted to ask you to comment, and I think you've covered it in the book, but I've forgotten what you said. A couple of years ago, Helen gave a live interview at the Wheeler Centre, and it was either just before or just after she published This House of Grief, mm-hmm. and she said out loud, I'm not sure if it was a throwaway line, it could be the self-deprecation, but she said, you know what, I think it's all the same book. I look back over these books and it's all the same book. Yeah. And it was also that same interview where she'd quoted Roth in sort of saying every time she wrote, she was driven by a sense of moral emergency. Mm. So I just wondered if you just comment on that one book comment, just from all the research you've done.
Mm, love to, because I use that as the epigraph to the introduction. It's all one book anyway, where she's actually taken a long piece from Philip Roth in the Paris Review of Fiction about, he says, look, everything is just one book. It's the same dream you dream, even if it's six dreams, you keep on going. And Jennifer Byrne was interviewing her and says, is it one book? Absolutely, it's one book. I come to the conclusion that it's not one book, but it is, I suggest, a modulating musical score, sometimes discordant, but always talking to each other. I think, in a sense, the one book of what I make of my life and the world in which I live, yes, which is why it was such a treat to write about her work, in a sense, as a global, 40 years worth in one book. David Malouf says a similar thing. Every serious writer, he says, writes about the same issues throughout their work. It's all sort of one book grappling with that issue, even though they're quite different books. So is it one book? Well, it might be, but it's a bit of a strange baggy beast if it is all in one book. But it's very much about a narrative of what I've made of my life and my world for 40 years, and it's still going. So we don't know where it's going to go, which is kind of exciting.
Yeah. Do you have a hint of what she's writing?
Not allowed to say.
Okay. But there's something.
There's something. Can I just say one thing before we finish, which is to thank Susan, because I wasn't allowed to have an index in this book, which is a shame, but if there was an index, you would have seen Susan Wyndham's name through it again and again because of the work you've done over all these years in your role as the head literary journalist and as a literary journalist and a great reader and writer herself. Again and again, I found myself quoting Susan's interviews or profiles with Helen at different stages of her career because you're such a careful reader and then you interview her and then you write in this way. So thank you to you too.
Thank you. And I have to say I was really honoured to be the person who commissioned that piece, Dreams of Her Real Self, that went into an anthology I edited about losing a parent, and then Helen has reproduced in her latest collection, and it's been recognised as a wonderful piece of writing, and it really is. So I'm glad to have given that birth. But you can see you're going to have to read Bernadette's book now. There's so much more to explore, and it really is a wonderful piece of work. So please thank Bernadette for this great conversation. Thank you.